We all know that the problem is immense, but what I'd like to do in today's talk is to kind of do what an agronomist always does, and that's to integrate. One of the levels of integration that I'm going to do is by integrating the opinions, basically, of three co-authors. Ken Kassman, who's giving a talk at exactly this time, a couple doors down. Tice Tolinar, who was my colleague and actually a PhD advisor at the University of Guelph. And this then will kind of be where we get started. And where it gets started for me was actually in my first course called Plant Agriculture. And this was a plant agriculture course taught in 1973 at the University of Guelph by Dr. Jack Tanner, a person who later became the head of Crop Science Department. And a lot of his enthusiasm for plant agriculture being at the forefront of being able to feed the world was what excited me about going into the crop science field in the first place. And the book that he used in his course called Plant Agriculture in the fall of 1973 was instrumental in sort of shaping my passion, I guess, for trying to look at ways in which we could increase food production sustainably. Now, in the sort of along the same lines as Malthus, perhaps, there was this Limits to Growth report, first published in 1972. And it basically ran a model. The model was basically based at MIT. The three co-authors were also from MIT, and they were commissioned essentially to do a Club of Rome report where they would look at the future in terms of interacting systems. And those interacting systems, all part of so-called global economic system, was population growth, food production, industrial production, pollution, and consumption of non-renewable resources. And it's been interesting in the various commentaries that have come out of late, the most recent one being by CSIRO in 2008, that some of these predictions, at least as far as food production are concerned, were fairly much in line with what was predicted in this model, which was essentially developed for the period of 1900 through to 2100. And it had various scenarios in terms of optimism or pessimism, but it all of them kind of pointed to certain restrictions on population growth that would have to occur over time because of perhaps inadequacies in overall food production or because of pollution. And so the bottom line, though, is we are essentially at about 6.7 billion people today, and we're expected to go to 9 billion by about 2050. So what do we need to know? And I thought that so at least you go home with one takeaway. The answer is more. So you all got that. We can all go. But the questions, though, behind that are more at what levels of organization within the plant itself and within the plant community and the plant community in an environment. And, of course, when, where, and by whom are all pertinent questions whenever you talk about more. And to some ears, the concern is really not all that great. In fact, when you look at maize, rice, and wheat yields, essentially over time, they look like they're on a steady linear increase. And so in a way that doesn't really look alarming at first blush. Perhaps a little bit of a concern that the wheat yields are not trending up as quickly as those for maize. Another area of concern that is certainly related to yield on a per hectare basis is the total grain area that is essentially available. And this is a slide I borrowed from Ken Kassman, which basically points to the fact that the area of maize, rice, and wheat is growing, but in some cases that's at the expense of the total grain area when you add in barley and millet and oats and sorghum and these other so-called minor crops. The issue, though, of the where we're going in terms of that linear increase that we've observed has to be understood in different in a different manner. And I would argue today that we should be more concerned about the rate of increase than we are about the flatline linear increase. And in fact, this was raised recently by a group of agricultural economists who published in Science, and Elston was the lead author, and he basically makes the point that for soybeans, for rice, for wheat, and for maize, during the period from 30-year period from 1961 to 1990, we essentially had a rate increase in actual yields on a per hectare basis of at least 2%, and in wheat at least as high as 3%. And these same economists point with some alarm to the period of 1990 to 2007, that 17-year period, in which the actual rate of increase is below 1% for soybeans, rice, and wheat, has also declined for maize, and in wheat it's perhaps declined the most, at less than half of 1%. And that is of concern when you match that with the rate of population growth, again on a percentage basis. Is this something that's only occurring on a global scale? No, it's also occurring on a U.S. scale. And in this slide, adapted from some of Tolinar's earlier presentations, I basically want to point out the fact that when U.S. yields are expressed on a percent increase basis for all of the counties of individual production, for the whole period from the blue being the 1930s, going on to the greens being the 1970s, and the reds being the 1990s, yields are increasing, as you can see here on the x-axis. But what is most disturbing is that if we look at the centroid of where the relative rate of increase is, it was at one time as high as about 3% and has now gone to less than 1%. And so the increases that we're achieving, although linear on a percentage basis, are not nearly as encouraging. Corn yields are, of course, also dramatically different whether we're talking about the U.S. or whether we're talking about the world, as two examples. And so in the U.S., an increase here of some 113 kilograms per hectare per year, but a much smaller increase than that in the whole world, and yields of really only less than 5 tons for the example of maize. And in Ken Kassman's brilliant analogy, he's essentially kind of put the perspective on in terms of some of the agronomic changes that have been key and parcel to the whole increase in yield from the time of essentially single cross hybrid use in the mid-1960s in the United States. And he would argue then that there are a large number of agronomic contributions to this increase that has occurred in time. From irrigation, perhaps some increase in nitrogen rates through about the early 1980s, integrated pest management, and then the transgenics, and perhaps in the future, the two big issues that every seed company in corn at least wants to do, and that is to improve nitrogen use efficiency and to increase drought tolerance, or be able to produce that higher yield with less water per unit. It's also encouraging, I think, because of the fact that nitrogen fertilizer rates have been essentially level here in the U.S., that if we express the grain yield per unit of nitrogen as a partial productivity factor, then essentially we've actually seen some increase since the 1980 period in the actual grain yield per kilogram or per unit of nitrogen that's been applied. But where Ken Kassman and our authors have some concern, when we talk about yield potential in a crop like maize, and most of my examples from here on are going to be about maize, we have some concern that that in the U.S. and in some of the areas that produce, let's say, contest winners, and here I'm focusing on Nebraska only because this slide came from Ken Kassman, Essentially, since about the early 1980s, the yields of 20 to 22 tons per hectare have been achieved here in the blue. And it's alarming to me that the if yields of 20 tons were attained in 1980, how come we aren't at 25 tons today? We're not there. What is encouraging, though, in terms is the relative rate of increase that has occurred in rain-fed conditions. And this is, again, an example from Nebraska, but you could duplicate the same thing if you chose your data from Iowa or if you chose your data from Illinois or God's country, which is Indiana. So where do we go forward? Or should that be Ontario, which is where I was born? Given the Ontario people in the front on the right. Okay, corn yield predictions. The most recent that I've seen of corn yield predictions is published in 2009, Plant Physiology. The author's company employer is really no secret. But anyway, the yields that are estimated here are going from approximately 9.5 ton in 2005 with an optimistic projection of a U.S. average of some 21 tons per hectare by the year 2030. How is this going to be accomplished? And I think it would be kind of interesting to look at the proportion that's going to supposedly come from genetics and the proportion that's supposedly going to come from agronomy. And so the agronomic side of it is the base. And we'll accept that as agronomists because agronomists are always being stepped on. But anyway, where is the rest of it going to come from? Well, it's going to come from conventional breeding. And so that's pointed out here through 2015, 20, and so forth. But increasingly, the genetic portion of expected yield increases is going to come about by two means. One, through the additional improvements resulting from marker-assisted breeding, and then secondly, from the so-called biotechnology traits that will enhance yield as much as almost conventional breeding has done in the current period. And so what's happening in terms of the expectation on agronomy? And you'll notice pretty small increases over here. And so the question is this fair, or is the focus perhaps need to change in terms of the ratio of those improvements that are going to come about genetically versus agronomy? And to be fair, everything about crop improvement is always 100% G by E. And it's difficult to perhaps divide into a genetic portion and a agronomic portion because the truth is yield is always a combination of both. And but anyway, as a backup for the progress that is expected in marker-assisted breeding, this is what the what some of the basis for that is. And it's an article published in Crop Science 2 years ago about the greater potential for making gains on a multi-trait basis, including yield, in the breeding populations. And so that's some of the background for that. But there's very little background for how that biotechnology improvement in actual yield potential of hybrids by 2030 is going to come about. Ken Kassman's view on this is that there is a little bit of a fairy tale, perhaps. And we all want to believe in fairy tale, at least when we're 3 years old. The question is, when we get to 30 or we get into our 50s, as I am, is that still believable? And so the bigger question then is, not so much is it believable, but what are we to do in order to assist that greater yield to be achieved? And I think that's where I'd like to kind of focus perhaps the rest of the talk. Genetics versus agronomy. Another a ratio perhaps of the proportion that's going to come from genetics versus that from agronomy was a result of Duvick's work with the era hybrids. The era hybrids were basically pioneers, bestsellers during the various decades from the 1930s up to the 1990s. And when they were grown with using 1990 technology, then the hybrids yield, even the hybrids from the 30s yielded more. But in essentially, we've got this yield component that is due to genetics being perhaps about 65% and agronomy 35%. But whether agronomy's contribution is 35% or 50% is perhaps less instructive than how are we going to increase that knowledge base in the future. Well, I think we're going to increase that knowledge base in part by understanding the past. And no one has done that better than has Theis Tolinar in terms of looking at what is different in today's hybrids versus those of decades earlier. And so this is just a look at his older hybrid, newer hybrid, same overall maturity, and the much faster senescence of the old hybrid. Another is, of course, the recognition, especially by Don Duvick's work, of the interaction of the year of hybrid introduction with its optimum plant density, and the fact that the big advantage of the 1990 era hybrids over those from earlier years is the fact that it yields much higher at higher densities. At lower densities, the new hybrids really don't yield materially more than the old hybrids of the 30s and 40s and 50s. Much of that increase, when we look backwards, has come about not from kernel weight, because of the fact that that's only been increasing at the rate of about 0.22% per year, but that increase has come about essentially because of kernel number. And in fact, in Tolinar's work, he estimates that about 85% of it has come about because of increased kernel number. This is shown here a little bit, the grain yield, and this is expressed on a grams axis. Over on the far side is essentially the kernel number per grain, and so you can see what a tight relation one of these densities, going from 0.5 plants squared to 8. 8 plants per meter squared is, of course, the same thing as 80,000 plants per hectare, and that would be about the same thing as 32,000 plants per acre. But anyway, my key point here is that the very, very tight relationship of yield with kernel number, and that's something that that was decided, proven to be a very, very tight relationship. And then as we go forward, we have to recognize that getting high kernel numbers is in part of what happens with the niche of inbreds, two of those, CG60 and MBS1236, and grown at in environments where they had much different plant growth rates occurring in terms of grams per plant per day. And essentially, the good news about the hybrid that results in us going up to a kernel number of almost 600 kernels per, number one, the fact that there is a high potential kernel number, but as important is the fact that it really doesn't take very much of a plant growth rate in order to set kernels in the first place. So kernel establishment is very, very critical, and it's especially critical in situations where the plant growth rate during the period bracketing, silking, and so on, it actually occurs. Another key part that Tolinar learned was the fact that there is a large difference in functional stay grain, which is really the photosynthetic carbon dioxide fixation that occurs during the grain filling period. So this is tassel, this is silking, and this goes on out to about 6 weeks after silking. And the key difference in the newer and the old hybrids wasn't the fact that the new hybrids were really any better than the old hybrids in right around silking time or the first 2 weeks, but was the fact that these newer hybrids essentially stayed not only green in terms of leaves, but maintained a high photosynthetic capability much longer in the grain filling period. And so the old hybrid then, in this work published in Field Crops Research, had a much lower capability at the end of the season. The big issue besides water and drought is always nitrogen, and perhaps one of our recent publications on plant density influences on grain yield and nitrogen use efficiency might be instructive. Again, we're looking backwards. We're looking at hybrids introduced in 2004. And when we try to grow those at high yield levels of about 12 tons per hectare for, in this case, 2005, this bottom case is for growing yields of about 14 tons per hectare, which we achieved in 2006. And when we look at the yield as well, and looking at nitrogen use efficiency at three different rates of nitrogen, for three different plant densities. The three nitrogen rates here are 0, 165, and 330. Obviously, 330 way above optimum. 165 in this environment was very near the optimum for a corn-soybean rotation when you're in our environment. So on the one level, you could say, well, and the A's and the B's here refer to statistical differences in nitrogen use efficiency. But anyway, you could say that there is a gain that's occurred in nitrogen use efficiency at 79,000 versus 54,000, and that at a density of 104,000, which is about 42,000 plants per acre. Again, there's been an increase in nitrogen use efficiency. Now, this is all assuming a nitrogen use efficiency calculation, which is essentially based on the delta or grain yield. In other words, a change in grain yield as a function of nitrogen applied. But you notice that this NUE designation for, let's say, the top density, 104,000, looks to be pretty good at about 40%. But you notice that it is entirely artificial. And it's artificial because of the fact that the yield at the zero nitrogen level has been dropping from 54,000 down to 104,000. And so although it looks like our nitrogen use efficiency at this density is improved, it's a function, really, of the drop in grain yield that has occurred in response to this high density. And it's because of work like this that I think it's essential that in genetic programs, as well as in physiology and management programs, we focus on multiple stresses at the same time. Nitrogen and plant density, for instance, are two of those. But the way that we help our breeding community is by alerting them to the fact that nitrogen use efficiency, number one, has a whole multitude of ways of actually being calculated, all of them in the scientific literature. But number two, that the inferences that you make at a plant level, at a cellular level, at a molecular level, are entirely assumed and going to be dependent on the environment in which it's tested. So it's essentially source versus sink. Do we need change in source? Do we need a change in sink? And Tolinar's work over the decades really has confirmed that the change in the sink must exactly equal the change in the source. And so a biotechnology approach which focuses only on perhaps improving source is designed to fail in the absence of an equal effort on changing the sink. And he's illustrated that here, and in terms of the source side, the sink side, and pointed out on the source side the importance of the visual stay grain, as well as, more importantly, the functional stay grain during the post-silking period. And in terms of the sink developments, especially, again, I'm focusing on the dry matter partitioning in the period around silking as being extremely important. So in estimates, then, of how much of a change in dry matter accumulation could we make for a crop like maize, there's a couple of routes to go. One would be to assume increased stress tolerance. Number two would be to assume increased functional stay grain. And number three would be to try to move the silking period earlier during the period of high radiation actually occurring. And so these are crop growth rates over here expressed as grams per meter per day. And then these are expressed as a function of days after silking from a period of more intense light to a period of lower photosynthetically active radiation towards the end of the grain filling period. And the first one here is in a stress situation. The RUE max at about 1.7 grams per megajoule. The second graph here is assuming that the stress is removed, but we still have this loss in functional stay grain that occurs near the end of the, or all along in grain filling period. And the third one assumes that basically we maintain our photosynthetic capability during the entire period. Scenario number one, perhaps has yields as we currently have, somewhere close to 10 tons per hectare. If you assume no stress during that grain filling period, then it's possible to think in terms of 16 or 17 tons per hectare. If you assume no leaf senescence and essentially the retention of a functional capability, then perhaps yields on maize could go as high as 24, and maybe that then makes possible the earlier forecast that I referred to written in Plant Physiology last year, or this year. And number three, and this is perhaps the ultimate, is essentially extending the grain filling period by 1 week by moving it earlier in a period of full light interception. Now all of this, in terms of looking backwards at how we've come to current yields, is important, but it's also important to continue to do in areas where the management itself is changing with respect to tillage, with respect to how nitrogen is applied, with respect to how seed beds are created. And unfortunately, it all has to be considered within the light of funding, and especially the relative amount of funding that goes into basic research as it compared to applied. And last night's talk by Gabisa Ejeta, as well as Roger Beachy's talk earlier, again referred to applied. But I'd like to point out that the top three are essentially basic research. And I'd like to express the total funding available in millions of dollars annually, expressed as a constant $2,006. And in that regard, the top funding is really going to genomics. So you wonder why we have had this change in the balance of people at the faculty level towards molecular geneticists, and it's essentially driven by funding. What's happened in terms of production management? Production management is here in the X's, and you can kind of see that although there's a very small increase here in constant dollars, it's essentially remained flat for this 8 or 9 year period. Funding drives science, and funding is essential if the agronomists are going to make the 35 or the 50% contribution to future yield gains. So I think, though, that that's not to speak disparagingly at all about our the people in the plant breeding, and especially those in the molecular biology profession. We need them, but we need them with a balance of crop physiologists, and we need them with a balance of the perhaps even more applied agronomists. I think it's essential to keep the focus on genetics by environment. And I think it's especially important that agronomists be more involved in designing experiments for simultaneous stresses, whether it's multiple abiotic or whether it's abiotic plus biotic. It's important to understand the multiple plant traits in complex multiple location trials, and especially to understand plant reactions at a more fundamental level than yield alone. Number four is the fact that I think that we've got to be more involved in pointing out what phenotypes should be measured. Breeding programs have changed tremendously. One of the phenotypes that has been best, I think, adopted most recently has been ASI. How many minutes do I have? Now, if it was only your introduction that was shorter. And achieving balance in source and sink relationships in different levels. But I think that we can be engaged. So in conclusion, The challenges of increasing crop production are not new, and I've just reflected back on my own career when I first became enthusiastic about plant agriculture as opposed to basic plant biology. Number two is the fact that we've got a lot of new tools. They're very impressive, but I think we're over-relying on the yield gains that can be made on biotechnological plant transformations alone. Agronomy, I would regard as extremely essential. Our success, of course, is going to be dependent on funding, but beyond funding alone, what are we looking for? Well, number one is we have to understand the physiology of past yield gains. Number two, we have to understand what's limiting our potential yields from being attained in current environments. Number three is I think we've got to be more involved with our breeding colleagues on the most appropriate phenotypes to test for. And then finally, we've got to be much more engaged at understanding multiple stress tolerances. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.